During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.
Hello, this is Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alexis Petridis.
And I'm Kieran Yates.
Coming up, we've got music from Big Kids, recorded at our live new Band of the Day session. There's tracks from Brianna Mary, Hot Chip and Major Lazer, plus 325 entries from the 1961 Hit Parade. As they might have said back then, stay tuned, Hepcats. And joining us this week, we have Alex McPherson. Hello, Alex.
Hi, everyone.
The big news that we should perhaps talk about is the appearance of Tupac.
Yeah.
At Coachella. What do we do? I missed this. I was at Coachella and brilliantly demonstrating my unique ability to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I'd already left by the time
I hadn't. But I thought as soon as you touched down, you'd be YouTubing it from your phone.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely not. I was in a car on the way back to LA to meet Bobby Womack. So just drop a few names in there. I didn't see it, but I was sort of amazed by it. Was that a good thing? Was anybody else amazed by it?
I guess if you were there, it would have been quite an amazing experience in the crowd, especially if you were sort of addled by the festivals, the things you do at festivals. But in the context of the last 13 years, 15 years, however long it's been since Tupac's death, it's not really that surprising. It's been sort of scraping the barrel for every way to make money out of his death.
Well, I'm surprised they didn't come up with the idea before, to be honest with you. It's like, every conceivable avenue, you know, to exploit the deceased figure of Tupac, with the possible exception of having him stuffed and mounted and brought on stage on a trolley.
Specifically, I'm surprised they didn't do it before Celine Dion, who's been doing this for years at her Vegas residency.
Who comes up and who appears?
Oh, yeah, Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
Pretty much everyone who ever wanted to duet with her in the first place.
That sounds really good.
One of the great points that I think you made, Alex, was that hopefully we're now going to hear about this hologram and lots of rap tunes over the next few months.
It is going to be, something like Tupac's hologram.
Lots of things rhyme with gram as well, so.
Absolutely.
Well, it's that terrible Drake catchphrase, YOLO. Holo, YOLO. It's going to happen.
YOLO.
We're not allowed to talk about Drake.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
We've got people who have been writing in complaining that there's been too much Drake chat.
Can we apply that to all music journalism ever from now on?
I think there's a lot to say about him, though.
Can we apply it to his mouth as well?
Poor old Drake. Having a hard time adjusting to fame. This is going to set a precedent. And I mean, you say Celine Dion did it, but Celine Dion sort of exists a little bit perhaps outside of the mainstream world of rock and pop, particularly performing in Vegas. She's more of a cabaret artist, perhaps. We will never be rid of holograms of dead people from this point on, will we?
It's going to sort of transform into a gimmick that gets quite tired quite quickly. Yeah. I'm not sure how many people will pay for it.
Queen. I guarantee you, because those two people, you talk about people scraping the bottom of the barrel, you know, I mean, those two remaining guys in Queen, you know, the same with anybody, you know, Five and that fella off American Idol or whatever. I guarantee you that the minute that YouTube footage hit, Brian May was on the phone to Holograms R Us going, mate, one of Freddie, we're going on the road again. That's good. That's a definite. Who should they bring back from the dead?
Biggie.
Aaliyah.
Oh, Aaliyah would be good.
Left Eye.
Actually, I don't want my favourite artist to be brought back from the dead in hologram form.
No. Well, I don't know.
Come to think of it. I don't want that at all. Queen can keep it.
But I missed the TLC live shows the first time round, and I missed that. So it might, you know, I mean, it might be a kind of a low-rent version, but still.
I could pretend. I don't think I'd pay for that.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you pay for gigs now, Alex? No.
No.
My vote for someone to bring back from the dead is Divine. I think if you're going to bring anybody back from the dead, bring an enormous fat drag queen shouting over the top of kind of pounding 80s high energy. That's the kind of thing I would actually pay very good money to see Divine in hologram form.
And, yeah, her entire career was kind of about turning herself into this gigantic machine of passion anyway.
Yeah, so absolutely. It would be absolutely amazing. And Divine, like, Divine doing, I think you're a man. That would just make my life, I think. Let's move on. At last, I now have the chance to use the term hit parade without irony. The British hit parade box sets released by Future Noise Music. They trawl through the charts of pop history. They have now reached the year 1961. This latest release has a CD for each month of the year. That's 325 tracks in total. The man behind them, Lorne Murdoch, came in to talk to Michael Hann. Question number one was, given that, generally speaking, 1961 has held up as an absolute nadir for popular music. Why?
There's a demand from various different sources for this sort of compilation. There are the chart completists who, rather than the same way that people in Victorian England used to collect moths and butterflies and pin them in their boxes, they just literally like to own every record that made the charts. They possibly don't care too much about it from a sort of aesthetic musical point of view, but they literally want to own them all, and they derive a fascination and a satisfaction from that. And then there are the people who are interested in it as a way of plotting the development of popular music, and more generally in the development of popular culture, which in those days tied in very closely with music.
So we should look on these as exercises in anthropology rather than the cheapy compilations you pick up from petrol stations for $2.99.
Well, certainly the amount of time and love that goes into it makes them very far removed from the budget quickie.
Now, the crucial thing, I guess, in combining these is that the music you're using is out of copyright. That's what enables you to put them together without
Absolutely.
It being...
Absolutely. It would be a much harder, but not necessarily impossible, task to do this if the music was still in copyright.
It's kind of unavoidable, the notion of the quality of the music on these compilations, because the early 60s, those years between Elvis going into the army and the emergence of the Beatles, are generally considered to be pop's absolute nadir. Can you honestly say that every song on a British Hit Parade compilation is worth listening to?
Well, I've listened to every song several times, believe me, and there's repertoire on there that I would listen to frequently, and there's repertoire I would listen to infrequently, and there's probably repertoire that once heard I wouldn't wish to listen to again. That is the nature of a compilation of hits. You are very much being objective. You have to put on there what was a hit, whether it's 1960, 1976, 1982. You have the same scenario, essentially, in as much as that there's always going to be stuff on there that one person likes and another person doesn't like, but you can't pick and choose.
I mean, when you combine the nature, as it says on the box sets, is that the box sets collectively present every recording to debut on the UK hit singles chart during each given year. Now, do you find yourself sometimes thinking, God, I wish such and such a single had been one place higher and that one place lower, and we could have got in that absolute stormer and left out, you know, how much is that doggy in the window? Or
it's hard to know, because... certainly in those days, I don't think there was a sort of bubbling underchart, so it's very hard to see what just missed out being on these compilations. Later on in the 60s, around about 1966, I think there's a chart called The Breakers, which was the next sort of 10 or so singles that just missed out on the top 50. And I suspect that if this venture continues into 1966, there would be a dilemma about, well, do we include those breakers or not? Would it make it a more interesting exercise or not?
So the chart was just a top 50?
At this
point.
Time, it was a top 50. It had, up until 1960, well, it had started as a top 12 in 53, but by 1960, it was a top 30, and then during 1960, it changed into a top 50.
And what's your personal feeling about the quality of the music from 1960 and 1961, which is where we're up to now in the series?
I think the quality of music coming out of America was pretty high, and a lot of that obviously made the British charts, because there's always been a massive audience in Britain for American pop music. I think the homegrown British music scene was struggling a bit. I think the major advantage perhaps the Americans had was the quality of the songwriting. 1960-61, you're starting to see people like Goffin and King, Sedaka and Greenfield, Lieber and Stoller, people like that, churning out amazing little pop songs of a very high quality. Over here, probably the most interesting songs being written were probably by someone like Lionel Bart for his shows like Oliver and Things Ain't What They Used to Be, and quite a lot of versions of those songs made it into the charts. But at that point, our sort of Tin Pan Alley songwriting wasn't, I would say, of the same quality of Americans, and that's probably one of the major impacts of the Beatles and the sort of beat boom of the sort of few years later.
And yeah, and you talk about the American music. I mean, we're still having hits from Eddie Cochran, from Buddy Holly. Yeah. There was Duane Eddy coming through. Whereas you look over at Britain, and realistically, in terms of exciting rock musicians, you're left with Johnny Kidd and the Pirates and not much more, aren't you, at that period?
Yeah, I think, yes. In fact, British fans sort of clung on to rock and roll, American rock and roll, more than the Americans. By 1960, Buddy Holly, Eddie Cochran, Gene Vincent, none of them were having US hits anymore. Now, obviously, Cochran and Holly were
recording from Beyond the Grave.
But over here, through 61, 62, right through to 64, there were hits for those artists coming out.
You don't like crazy music. You don't like rocking bands. You just want to go to a movie show and sit there holding hands. You're so square. Baby, I don't care.
Other artists were out of favour, like Jerry Lee Lewis, for marrying his sort of
13-year-old cousin, let's be honest.
Cousin, yes. Other artists, I think by this point, Little Richard, I think, had forsaken the devil's music for doing God's work. So rock and roll was coming to the end of its lifespan. I think most people consider the rock and roll era to be about 1955 through to 62. But by the end, it was pretty much played out. I would say possibly the more interesting developments in American music at this time were in R&B. It's the beginning of soul music. You've got some interesting sort of dance pop R&B type stuff like Chubby Checker and Gary U.S. Bonds, and there was the whole twist scene. Plus, of course, you've got the very beginnings of Motown. But the problem the American R&B had, as far as Britain was concerned, was very little of it came out over here. It was pretty much a lottery which R&B artists were picked up by British labels, which weren't. So, for instance, although there were early Motown hits in America for the Marvelettes, the Miracles and the Contours, I think the first Motown hits in America were once they'd been picked up by the stateside label for the UK in 1964.
Fantastic Voyage also puts out a whole load of other reissued materials, not just about these compilations. There's compilations for West Coast rock and roll, there's lots of rockabilly, there's individual artist compilations. Mm-hmm. How much effort and research does it take to kind of track down specialist compilations like that, to track down the music and to produce the best possible package of it?
Well, we work with a number of freelance compilers who have a considerable amount of experience of doing these sorts of compilations. And we very much avoided the route of just doing compilations that are pretty much the same as what other people are doing. It would be very easy to churn out Elmore James best ofs, B.B. King best ofs, even the rock and roll, all the hits and things like that. What we try to do is find a different angle, which means that you can mix in some of the familiar artists with some much harder to find repertoire. So, for instance, we'll do compilations picking on a city or a region in America. We will go for some very obscure stuff. There'll be some things typically on one of those compilations where it hasn't been on CD before. So we try and make it an attractive prospect for collectors.
And when you're doing single artist reissues, do you make an effort to try and track down the artist as well? I mean, are you able to pay them even though the work is out of copyright in any way?
Because the works are out of copyright, the only people who benefit from our compilations will be the publishers of the songs being performed and the writers of those songs, because the copyright on the published works is for a longer period than the actual recorded works.
Do you see yourself in competition with labels like Ace that are dealing in a kind of similar sort of area?
Ace are very much the benchmark label as far as we're concerned. The difference between us and Ace is that Ace have been in the business since the mid-70s, so A, they have a considerable amount of experience, and B, they've also, over the years, acquired a certain amount of catalogue. We have some catalogue that we own, but Ace have, over the years, acquired a considerable amount more. Mm.
Finally, I think we need to know from you, say, five records from 1961 that will actually provide a coherent argument for this being stuff that everyone should go out and investigate.
Actually, the first thing I would say is, if you'd said to me 1960... which was the previous box set we'd done, off the top of my head, I would immediately said that as far as pushing British music ahead, it was The Shadows Apache and Johnny Kidd and the Pirates Shaking All Over. Those were two tracks that I think were pivotal in inspiring the next generation of sort of what we'd now probably call the British beat groups to pick up guitars, form bands. I think in 61, no real developments in the British on the British side, really, other than the fact that I think Dusty Springfield started having records with the Springfields. But if I can just scan the back covers of these compilations for 1961.
So this is the problem of actually being given the chance to promote your own release.
There's some amazing records. For a start, Del Shannon had his first two hits, Hats Off to Larry and Runaway.
Runaway is the one everyone remembers.
Yes, Dion, first hit. But interestingly, the artists I'm choosing are American rather than British. But to balance that out, you've got the first few hits by Helen Shapiro. Probably my favourite hit from the year would be Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow by the Shirelles, which I think's significant on a number of counts. It actually, I think, first charted in America in 60, but it was a British hit in 61. It's significant because it sort of pretty much kickstarts the girl group sound, which fared pretty well in the early 60s. It's also, I think, the first number one for Goffin and King. So that's a very nice song to
And it's arguably select. The first song to talk seriously about sex from the perspective of a young woman rather than a young
Absolutely.
Man.
Absolutely. It doesn't really pull punches. It's a very interesting lyric. And for that reason, it definitely deserves identifying as one of the best songs of that year. And then in 62, the major developments probably are Phil Spector's first hit with the Crystals. There have been Spector hits earlier, but they've been unremarkable sonically. But that's when he's starting to experiment with the wall of sound. You've also got the first hit from the Four Seasons. In America, you've got the first hit from the Beach Boys. And over here, a fairly obscure band from Liverpool put out a slightly sort of ropey sounding to my ear single called Love Me Do. And that's the beginning of a new era in popular music.
That was Lorne Murdoch talking to Michael Hann. The 1961 British Hit Parade box sets are out now on CD or for download on iTunes. Let's move on to Singles Club. Guests first. Alex, let's start with your track. P-boy, you're a suicide. A-O-D, I'm a knockout. K-O-D, baby, I'm the shit. Toilet stop, dude. And I don't stink, I'm a showstopper. Pretty girl rock, call it Karen Hilson. Pretty girl rock, call it Karen Hilson. Fountain blue, we don't do the heel team. Pretty girl, Bree, bitch, I'm worth a zillion. I'm hollin' hood, arrogant, don't I look good? Marilyn, Monroe, Marilyn, Monroe. That was Brianna Perry with Marilyn Monroe.
Alex, you brought that in. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Brianna Perry. Tell us about this track.
She's a Miami rapper, and she is signed to Atlantic, and she's preparing her debut album for release this year. That song's been bubbling under the US charts for a while now. It's just received a video, which is fantastic. When I first heard it, it was the production that jumped out at me, and also her amazing voice, that sort of southern drawl, which she makes the best use of, that sort of arrogant, trying to rhyme with Marilyn, is just so catchy, it's an earworm. The production is handled by this guy called Kanan Lam, who's been Missy Elliott's co-producer for a while now. He also did Beyoncé's Countdown and Jasmine Sullivan's Need You Bad, which, and all of those together, he's definitely got away with the drum machine, I think. Brianna is actually someone that I didn't realise when I first heard this, but I first heard her 10 years ago, when she was 9 years old, on Trina's 2002 album, Diamond Princess.
I think we all heard that, didn't we?
Yeah. Yep.
If you remember that song with this 9-year-old rapper called Lil Brianna, that's her growing up.
All grown up.
And I remember being quite disturbed by the line, all the kids at school call me Baby Trina, because at the time, Trina was famous for, you know, rapping about sticking her cock in your face. So
What are you talking about? What's this discussion about? I'm sorry. There was somebody on the blog, and it's not playing the fuddy-duddy. You know, it's complaining that I was very, like, a fuddy-duddy. I've literally no idea what you're talking about. Who was sticking their cock in your face?
Trina, who is one of the best rappers of the past 10 years, one of my favourites. Yeah. Her starting point is if Lil' Kim wasn't sexually explicit enough.
What a great idea. She listens to Lil' Kim. You know,
and yeah, lots of you know, fun gender flipping as well.
Yeah. And, she was really influenced by Bitches With Problems, who was that 80s hip-hop girl band, and they were very sexually explicit as well.
And she's part of the whole sort of Miami booty scene with, like, Trick Daddy and Rick Ross and so on.
Okay, right, fair enough. Kieran.
Yeah, I really liked it. I really love the beat, and I think...
Yeah, I like the beat too.
What you were saying is I can hear that Missy Elliott influence, so it kind of makes sense that she's worked with her producer. And also that kind of Beyonce, Carrie Hilson... maybe Sierra, if they weren't so mainstream. It's also, she sounded a little bit to me when I first heard her as what I wished Kid Sister was, if she was still going and what she could have been. So yeah, I like that there's all those kind of influences there. And there's just something a little bit fascinating about, these kind of black female bolshy rappers talking about Marilyn Monroe in that way, this kind of the epitome of the white middle-class female aesthetic, and just talking about that so explicitly. And I think that it's really well done. It's quite an interesting song.
It's like reverse appropriation.
Yeah, exactly. She's good. What do you think, Alexis?
I liked it as well. I like the sort of tumbling beat. The initial part of it, I can't work out what it made me think of, but it made me think of an older hip-hop track. I think the breakbeat sounded quite old school. And yeah, I really liked it. I thought it was really good. It's really inventive. She's got a really good voice.
Really funny as well. I think one of my favourite bits that I didn't actually get this for ages. In the second verse, she starts off with, "I think I'm going blonde, Marilyn. So I bought more Maryland." And I was like, and you kind of don't hear it at first, but it's because of her southern drawl, Baltimore sounds like Baltimore. And Marilyn sounds like Maryland.
Okay.
And it's just one of those rap Easter eggs that sort of leaps up at you.
That's great. And when's that? Is that knocking around the internet?
It's knocking around the internet. I think it's been released in the US, but not the UK. But she does have a deal with Atlantic, so it's not going to be one of those that disappears, hopefully.
Wonderful. Kieran, let's see what you brought in. Major Lazer, that's called Get Free. It features Amber Kaufman of the Dirty Projectors. I have to say, I'm pleased to find a record by somebody from the Dirty Projectors that I actually want to listen to. Because I find them trying in the extreme as a band. I appreciate they're very popular with amongst the kind of hipster fraternity and that kind of thing. I find their records a total pain in the arse.
I'm glad that they sort of removed her voice from the band.
Yeah, it sounds, and the backing is great. I really like that.
It's great, yeah. So this is from Major Lazer, which, if you don't know, is kind of Diplo and Switch's side project, their kind of futuristic dancehall project, which is incredibly concept-based. I think the concept is that Major Lazer is this Jamaican militant at war with an army of mummies and vampires and zombies.
In the grand tradition of sort of Lee Scratch Perry or scientist versus, scientist wins the World Cup or whatever.
Like all those mad scientists reworking the Massive Attack albums, which are really crazy, zombies and the animations and illustrations are always really interesting.
Don't you think there's something a bit weird about two white guys like Diplo and Switch doing that? I have the greatest of respect for Switch as a producer. I think he's a great producer. Diplo's another matter, and Diplo's got a long history of basically thieving people's beats, thieving people's culture, being a total faddist about it as well. Diplo is one of the worst people in music right now, I think.
Well,
I have no opinions about this at all.
I think Diplo's just everywhere at the moment. I've seen, he's kind of jumped off the back of so many remixes, he's done so many reworks, but what I like about Major Lazer is that there's just this kind of uncompromising bolshiness about the way they do dancehall, and it has got this kind of fusion with electronica, and it sounds that kind of futuristic thing like this just sounds like you can hear all those reggae inflections, you can hear ska and dub, but really it's just these ridiculous disorientating vocals from Amber Kaufman, which almost sounds a bit like these K-pop interjections now and again, these really weird wails, and she's got a bit of a bizarre voice anyway, kind of like a bit of a warped Bjork. And I think that it just works really well with this. And, Major Lazer traditionally with the Guns Don't Kill People, Lasers Do album and Upon the Floor, it was, it was really reflected in the videos. It's just these, these big women just shaking their booties, daggering and just looking, crazy. And it was just this big, uncompromising dance hall. And this is a little bit more restrained. And it's, I guess, maybe a little bit more contemplative, reflective dancehall, which is what they've done, which is what I really like about it.
I really liked it. I'm not bothered about two white guys doing reggae. I think it's a bit late to start complaining about white people making reggae records. You know, kind of maybe you could have done that. I don't know. When did white people start making reggae records? Who's that white band that was signed to Trojan? Simmerip? I can't remember.
I was just going to say Mick Hucknall.
Mick Hucknall runs. Great, whatever you think of Mick Hucknall, great curator of classic reggae, of course, runs the Blood and Fire label, responsible for releasing all kinds of things, including Heart of the Congos by the Congos. Sting, you know, white reggae. I don't know, the Specials, whatever, right. You know. I really liked it. I thought it was very... it wasn't what I was expecting to hear. What I like about this track is it moves the spaciness and the weirdness of dub on. It doesn't sound like somebody's sitting at home, you know, trying to recreate either an old Prince Tubby record or an old sort of, you know, digi-dub record or something like that. So, yes, I liked it. Alex?
Mm-hmm. I didn't like it, although not so much for the beat as actually... You were talking about disliking Dirty Projectors earlier, which I also disliked them intensely, and it's actually a lot because of their voices. And Amber Kaufman, that note she sustains, is it even a note? It just hurts my ears. Why do indie vocalists yelp so much? They just sort of yelp like little terriers.
I like that, though. I like that sort of taking it out of that indie kind of sphere of music and putting it here where it doesn't fit so easily. But it kind of, I think, to my ear, it kind of weirdly works. And when she did that track with Rusko a couple of years ago, that Hold On track, it was just absolutely amazing because her voice is just weird enough to kind of sustain these gentle dub beats, but also big dubstep beats as well, and I think that I quite rate that.
When is this out? When is this available?
So this is going to be released from Mad Decent, which is Diplo's label, and yeah, who knows when.
But it's available on the internet.
It's available on the
internet.
I don't
know why I bother asking this now. It's like, is it available on the internet? Yes.
The video's really cool as well. You should check it out.
Oh, cool. So that's two cool videos we should check out this week. The video for the next track, which is my choice, is really boring. the one that's been up. Anyway, let's hear it.
Getting me down. Nothing's making sense in my brain. I'm moving words across the terrain, trying hard to fix to the page. I'm wedded to the thought that we came, only to discover our names and blow up all of love and refrain.
That's Hot Chip and Flutes. It's the first track to be taken from their forthcoming album, which I think is out in June, their first album for Domino Records. I really like that. I think Joe Goddard from Hot Chip is turned into a really brilliant producer. And I wasn't always a huge Hot Chip fan. I genuinely think they've got better and better as a group. And their albums have also got sort of more consistent. One Life Stand, the last album, I really thought it was a sort of consistently brilliant album, whereas previously I thought there was two or three good tracks on each Hot Chip record. And I think this is just got a really good beat. It's got a really good, you know, the backing to it is brilliant. It's a really interesting take on house music. It's a really interesting take on sort of deep house. It's not slavishly trying to copy anything. It's very much defined its own space as a record. And got a tune on top of it. I kind of hope it does well. I was on the sort of verge of becoming really big, and it never quite seems to... You know, apart from...
wasn't that Over and Over Tune?
Over and
really
Over
big,
Tune,
yeah.
Which was like sort of huge. It's never kind of quite broken in the way I think it could. You know, right. What I mean? I think every album's had sort of a bit of a killer single on it. It's right. Never come like smash it, expected. So there you go. Maybe
who would you make a comparison to, Hot Chip, who are quite big?
I think that's kind of an interesting point, isn't it? Because don't think... I'm thinking that when I saw them at the Mercury's when they were nominated and they came on and did Over and Over. Yeah. And it was kind of boring Mercury's that year. And I thought, well, this is actually... There you go, it's five guys or whatever it was, standing all in a row playing synth. I thought, this is genuinely different. The way you've presented this is different. You know, I can't think of an artist really like Hot Chip, anymore.
I'd compare them to Phoenix. That's a sense of one foot in dance, one foot in indie. And it actually doesn't surprise me that Hot Chip have never broken through, because to me they're the ultimate journeymen of music. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sort of trundle away in the background. They work hard, they've got a decent live show. They're much better live than on record. No one really hates them. Everything is adequate. And they sort of just trundle along in the background, sort of snowballing, building up fans, and they'll never go away. And
They have got a very big following, haven't they?
Yeah, they've got a live, big live following. Phoenix feels to me, I think there's actually something, I appreciate this, that Alexis Taylor, wonderfully named Alexis, his voice, probably isn't your cup of tea, but I actually think the songs are about stuff, whereas Phoenix's record always strike me as being an exercise in trying to create like perfect pop music. And it always feels like they've been put together in a laboratory with a pair of tweezers. Whereas, you know, I think Hot Chip write songs about things. One Life Stand.
This does feel a little bit more organic, doesn't it? That's what I quite like about it. It's got this really amazing kind of build-up, and it's musically quite great. The sort of, when I first heard it, you know, those kind of almost childlike voices at the beginning, they reminded me, I don't know why, but a little bit of Deep Forest. Of that kind of album, you know, those like, and I really liked it. And it's quite interesting, you know, the key changes, they're really clever with how they do that. It's not very obvious. They're, you know, they're very apparent, but actually I think they're quite subtle and they work really, really well. And I think I just quite like the audacity of Hot Chip, really. I mean, they're, you know, as you say, they've got one foot in indie. They come, they make this great dance track. It's 8 minutes long. It's, you know, it's got all these kind of, you know, really obvious, almost naff-sounded 80s synth sounds in it. And it just really works. And I think, yeah, I think you've got to give them props for that.
Yeah, I think it's great that Hot Chip, for once, have a really proper propulsive dance beat. Although it's got his voice in it. It's so quavery and it's so milquetoast. I can't listen to it. Joe Goddard's single that he did with Valentino last year is so much better to me.
Mm.
And, you know, when I want to listen to house music, Hot Chip still don't quite cut it. They're not, like, up there with the producers who get me most excited right now, mm-hmm. not, like, Livon Vincent or Huxley or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
There's still enough. Some journeyman in dance as well.
Fair enough. Well, there you go. Hot Chip's Flutes is around and about on the internet. You can find it on SoundCloud. The video is all over the shop. And that's Singles Club for this week, yes. A few days ago at the Barfly in Camden, we had the third instalment of our new Band of the Day live sessions. Paul Lester, our new band detective, spoke to Mr. Hudson and Rosie Oddie, that's Bill Oddie's daughter, fact fans, otherwise known as Big Kids. Plus, we've got a live track from their set.
It's a bit of a juggernaut of enthusiasm. I think if people want to stand in the way, they're welcome to try. Do you know what I mean?
Was it an antidote to something? Was there a reason you got together to do this?
It was. I don't know if it was an antidote, but it was certainly a tonic. You know, personally for me, like touring my arse off, traveling the world. I wore out a passport. How many people do you know who've worn out a passport? I wore my passport out. I needed to connect back into what I like. I like musical instruments. I'd very much gone down that pop road as Mr. Hudson, and I wanted to just have, like, I wanted to sit at the keys or have a guitar around my neck and just get a little bit back to my roots of kind of being a singer-songwriter in North London.
Totally.
And I met Rosie, and she just, like...
How did you meet?
I went to see a couple of Rosie's shows. I saw it at the Lexington on Pentonville Road and the Wheelbarrow in Camden, and I was like, I love this girl's voice. If I'm going to be real, it was getting a little bit lost in the distorted guitars. I was like... The first thing I said to Rosie when we got into my little studio was, I don't know what we're going to do, but I think we've got to do it.
Right.
And we just hit the red button, and I started making beats and putting chord structures together. And Rosie and I, we write as I do that, so I'll be on the computer and, like, sort of throwing junk around, you know. It's kind of scrap heap challenge, isn't it? And then we'll just sort of figure out what the song's meant to be. It's like reverse engineering. It's like making the record and then figuring out what the song was like that was written to then produce that record. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess, like, that juvenile dementia comes across. Big Kids, is that like reversion to childhood? Is it the fun you never had at the time? You must have had an appalling childhood.
That was terrible. Awful.
Terrible.
Just beaten every day.
Yes. I saw your father in the audience.
Oh, it's great. He's really supportive, and it's great that he came down. Yeah.
And you're lucky that, you know, you grew up in a house with a drum kit in the living room.
Yeah,
and,
totally.
And acoustic guitars, you know.
Well, and
percussion. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah. I think the Big Kids thing just came from about having fun, and I think there's a Big Kid. Everyone wants to be a Big Kid.
Mm.
Everyone wants to do things that kids did. So,
yeah.
What do kids make of it? I mean, you know, you think it would
but
be
it's not,
really popular.
I don't think it necessarily is for kids.
I don't think the kids can even hear it, because kids can't come to bloody gigs, can they?
Right. Drumming Chester, you can imagine being very popular in the playground.
Yeah.
In a good way.
In a dancey way.
Yeah.
I can't speak for Rosie, but personally, my music making is always quite selfish in terms of what do I like, what's coming out of speakers, do I think this is good?
Right.
You know, and I certainly hadn't contemplated what our demographic was, you know. You don't...
That's not really your problem, I guess.
No. And if it were, I wouldn't find the solution. Do you know what I mean?
If you start trying to make music for a certain range of people, is that you're on a hiding to nothing?
You're not going to be very happy, and there'll be some kind of rebellion which happens at some point if you're trying to make music for other people, I think.
Yeah.
Unless you're the kind of person that's what occurs.
Unless you're not proper, unless you're not an artist.
If your instinct is, oh, I'd quite like to make music that makes money or like, that's really successful, yeah, that's like fine. Thing. That's fine if that's your instinct, but if it's not, then don't try and, you know, don't try and put a square peg in a round hole.
Okay, so I'll wrap this up by asking you the key question. 2012, what are you going to do next?
Is it 2012?
What's the master plan?
There isn't one.
No, have fun, drink beer.
Yeah, we'll make an album. We're doing a bunch of festivals. We're doing Bestival, Secret Garden. You know, we're just going to have some fun over the summer, and then I guess maybe just as everyone goes back to being serious in September, but maybe we will and kind of try and mix an album, see what we've got by the end of the summer. Put 10 tracks on a CD and try and get someone to market it. But, you know, I think we'll just cross that bridge when we come to it.
That was Big Kids, recorded at our latest New Band of the Day live session at the Barfly in Camden. That, my friends, is it for this week. Thanks to Alex for joining us. Let us know your thoughts at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. We'll be back in a week's time, but until then, thanks for listening.
During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.